On today's episode of This Week in Space, we're back with our friend Jeffrey Notkin to talk meteorites. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 69, recorded on July 7th, 2023. A meteorite in my attic. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that drastically increases your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the Tossing Rocks from the Orbital Overpass edition. I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and I'm here with the iconical Tarek Malik, editor-in-chief at space.com. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well, Rod. It's Friday, which means I get to talk to you. So it's the best day of the week.
That's a privilege. joining us today, however, is a bigger privilege. Jeffrey Notkin, who's, among many other achievements, starred in 3 seasons of Meteorite Men for Discovery Networks, 2 seasons of STEM journals, for which he received 2 Emmy Awards as compared to my 0. He has appeared in shows for Nat Geo, History Channel, Travel Channel, TLC, PBS, A&E, NASA, and the BBC. He's an author, world traveler, TEDx speaker, Edinburgh Fringe Festival performer, and is the former CEO of Aerolite Meteorites Incorporated. How are you today, sir?
Well, I'm splendid. Thank you, Rod and Tarek. Thanks for having me back. You know, I love the show, and I'm very excited about the special episode that we are doing today.
It is special because you're here. And to make it extra special, I have a joke.
Oh, best part of the week.
Now, right. I could not really find anything suitable for meteorites. I'm going to count on Jeff for that. But I decided to query Copy AI today. And here's the joke it gave me. Meteorologists are trying to figure out what could make a comet come down to us as a meteor. Chirp, chirp, chirp. I don't even know what that means. Okay, how about this? There we go. Okay, wait, you'll love this one. A little asteroid walks into a bar and says, "I'd like a martini." The bartender says, "No problem. We have many different types of martinis. One is made with vodka, but you can use gin instead if you want." The asteroid says, "No thanks. I'm a teetotaler." What? I don't even. Is that even a joke? Okay, what? Jeff. I know.
Should we rim shot just because it's really bad?
Wow. I mean, it should have said no because you're a Chevrolet. I just don't understand. Yeah, anything.
That was too far out for me, man.
Yeah. Well, what have you got?
Well, I didn't bring meteorite jokes. I brought space jokes.
Well, space
I hope
jokes
that's
work.
Okay. Okay. Because it's not, it's, I, alas, the show is not This Week in Meteorites. Well, and this week it is.
And clearly our listeners are falling down the job. So, listeners, it's time for you to do us a solid and send your jokes.
Meteorite jokes, please.
We live for your jokes.
Meteorite
jokes.
Why did Jeff Notkin send his salad back at lunch today?
Because
he wanted something meteor, right?
Oh!
No.
Did you just come up with that, Tarek?
Oh, no. I've used that joke on the show before, but that's a go-to.
Wait, have you been cheating on me? Did you have other meteorite specialists on the show?
No.
I think that was just the first joke that I ever dust off. It's that one and why astronomers are always so happy, because astronomy is always looking up.
Ah. Yeah. Okay. I've not heard that one before.
Okay, Jeffrey.
I got two new ones for you. Okay, here, number one. Why did the salty old spaceship deckhand say he'd be willing to work his passage to Mars, but only during the warmer months? Because he was a solar sailor.
Okay, you got a rim shot.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. This is my favorite. I've conducted a survey among astronauts. And here is a list of the most popular names for astronauts' dogs. And they are Lunar Rover, Mars Rover, Sunspot, Mission Patches, Alan Shepard, Buzz Aldrin, And the most popular dog's name among astronauts and, in fact, flight controllers is Fido.
That's a good one. Ant, that's an inside. No, that's a rim shot. That's an inside joke because there's a position in flight control called Fido.
He wants to fight you on that.
I'm like, I don't
flight know dynamics officer.
Dynamics. Oh, okay.
Sorry, it's not a sports thing. Thank you. Wow. Our harshest
double
critic.
Shot.
Wow. I think we'd better move on to some headlines here.
Please.
Why bother after the comedy?
We have
really
a whole show about space jokes. Let's just do that one day.
We're going to. But we have to have Jeff on to do it because he's the only one that brings good ones. All right. Headline one, farewell Ariane 5 from our friends at space.com, one of whom is here.
Yes.
Swan song, huh?
Yeah, that was it. If you never got a chance to see an Ariane 5 rocket launch, you are done because they are done. After 27 years, Ariane Space, the French-based rocket launch company for Europe, wrapped up their last and 117th mission of the Ariane 5 rocket. They launched a pretty hefty satellite, the Heinrich Hertz Experimental Communication Satellite, and they launched out of Kourou in French Guiana at the out of the Europe's European Space Agency's the European Space Agency's spaceport. It's just called Spaceport, I believe.
Somebody give this man some coffee.
I think sorry, maybe that's ahead. The problem. I had too much, but you know, kind of the end of an era for European launch programs, because this was kind of their big workhouse rocket. Now, they did have the smaller Vega C launcher. Now, that's been had its kind of ups and downs because of some recent failures. The Ariane 5 rocket had one failure in in 1996, and then aside from that, it had a 96% success rate over that period of time. And one of my favorite missions to launch on Ariane 5 just actually launched recently. That was the James Webb Space Telescope, but it also launched the European ATV, the automated transfer spacecraft, which is about as close to an X-wing as we were going to get until the Orion spacecraft started flying with their X solar arrays, and it's just kind of the end of a period and a transition now, because there is a new rocket and it's called Ariane 6 and it's supposed to start flying sometime soon. They just rolled it out to the launch pad and fired to do some launch tests recently. And that'll be the next big thing. It's supposed to launch no later than late 2023, as we're recording this. But they're going to have a gap. And so Europe's going to use SpaceX and a few other launchers to fill that, because they can't use Russia anymore because of the pause in the rocket stuff from the Ukraine war fallout.
Because they're naughty. All right, for this next one, I have to put on my special science glasses. From space.com, farthest black hole ever.
That's right. And it will not surprise you. We were just talking about the Ariane 5 rocket that launched the James Webb Space Telescope. And this is actually a discovery from the James Webb Space Telescope. And I guess there's some qualifiers here that we have to say, because this week scientists announced that they have discovered the most distant active supermassive black hole that they've ever seen, called Ceres 1019. That's not something that you can order from a catalog. It's actually CEERS, not Roebuck. And what they can see is that it looks like, oh, I got the crickets there. Wow. I'm not gonna ad lib anymore, Ant. But the black hole is located at the center of a galaxy. It's a supermassive black hole, and it's at the center of the galaxy CEERS 1019. And they think that the galaxy, you know, that it formed less than a billion years after the Big Bang. So 570 million years after. So that would be, you know, it's the furthest away. It's the most distant. It's the most ancient as well. And it's another clue as to how early in the universe's lifetime that these massive objects and the galaxies around them could actually form. And it weighs in at about 9 million solar masses, so it's 9 million times heftier than the sun, and usually that's, you know, we see them being billions of times more massive than the sun. So it's kind of a runt of the supermassive black hole litter there. But it's another benchmark, and we could possibly see this record be broken by James Webb, because we're just coming up on the 1 year anniversary of its science. So that's just 1 year, and it's found, you know, this like super early monster black hole.
All right. I love the comments on the Webb Space Telescope website, the site web page that says, "It's a bonanza. The universe is absolutely teeming with black holes." That sounds like Carl Sagan level enthusiasm there.
Sure does. All right. For our last story, not content to have the most people on the planet in one country ever, India will soon be laying a claim to the moon with Chandrayaan 3 from space.com.
That's right. This was a kind of a sleeper that's been going on in the background. But India is getting ready for its next moon mission, its second landing mission, and kind of a sequel and something that'll be better than their first one, which was the Chandrayaan 2 mission. But the Chandrayaan 3 mission, which is going to send a lander and a rover to the South Pole of the moon, or the South Polar regions of the moon, is currently set to launch on July 14th as we're recording this. And it has a bit of like a week long or so window to get there, and if everything goes right, they will land on the moon around August 23rd, August 24th. So it takes them about 2-3 weeks to get there. And this is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, India, it shows their commitment to getting to the moon. They launched Chandrayaan 1, an orbiter that was largely credited for helping NASA confirm the existence of water on the surface of the moon in terms of like ice around the South Pole. Chandrayaan 2, they included a rover and a lander, but they failed to get to the surface. Like it didn't land when it tried to get there. And so this new mission, Chandrayaan 3, Chandrayaan 1, by the way, 2008, Chandrayaan 2 was in 2019. Chandrayaan 3 has kind of like a better twin to the rover and the lander that they sent on Chandrayaan 2. It has improved thrusters for landing, better solar panels for power generation, etc. And they're going to they think that they've solved the issues that led to the loss of control of the lander on the way down, and they're really eager to try to get this done. And you know, they have, by the way, in the background, their own crewed program. Gangayaan, of astronauts that they're training that they would like to eventually also send to the moon, as well as orbit to do exploration. And so this just is like another arm to kind of show that they're making a lot of progress. And a lot needs to be said for India's space program, because while these missions seem like they're slow and far between, when they get there, they usually work for the most part. After, you know, they learn from the issues that might have been the last one. Their Mars orbiter mission did very well for being their first mission to Mars, and on a shoestring budget compared to NASA's Maven spacecraft at the time.
Very good. All right. We're going to be back in just a moment to talk to Jeffrey Notkin, our guest this week, as soon as we hear this short message from our friends at Bitwarden. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go, and is trusted by millions. Even our very own Steve Gibson has switched over. With Bitwarden, all the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, not just your passwords. You can protect your data and privacy with Bitwarden by adding security to your passwords with strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. And you can go further with the username generator, creating unique usernames for each account, or even use any of the 5 integrated email alias services. Bitwarden is open source with all the code available on GitHub for anyone to view. This means you don't have to take their word for it. You can see that it's completely secure yourself. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed every year, and the results are also published on their website. This is open source security that you can trust. Bitwarden has also launched a new Bitwarden Secrets Manager, which is currently in beta. It's an end-to-end encrypted solution that allows teams of developers to centrally secure, manage, and deploy sensitive secrets like API keys and machine credentials. Secrets Manager keeps those sensitive developer secrets out of source code and eliminates the risk of them being exposed to the public. Bitwarden needs developers to help test out the new Secrets Manager and provide feedback. You can learn more at bitwarden.com/secrets-beta. Share private data securely with coworkers, across departments, or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 per month per user, while the Enterprise organization plan is just $5 a month per user. Individuals, of course, can always use the basic free account for an unlimited number of passwords. And upgrade anytime to a premium account for less than $1 per month, or bring the whole family with their family organization option to give up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. Here at Twit, we're fans of password managers. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. You can get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. And we're back. Jeffrey Notkin, Meteorite Man.
He rocks.
NSS Board of Governors, former president of the NSS, punk rocker, movie producer. Did I miss anything? Oh, actor.
Science writer. You left out. Yeah. And sometime part-time joke writer for This Week in Space.
And author. Book author.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't forget that.
Well, thank you for the nice intro.
Well, and of your many accomplishments, the recent one was you were invited, unlike Tarek and myself, I might add, or I can only say myself, I don't know about Tarek, you were invited to attend and participate in Asteroid Day. So tell us about that, if you would.
With pleasure. What a fantastic event. So as you know, Asteroid Day is related to the B612 Foundation, an organization that was founded by astronauts Rusty Schweikart and Ed Liu about 20 years ago, actually exactly 20 years ago, to raise awareness about the dangers of asteroid collisions with Earth. And Asteroid Day takes place every year on June 30th, which is the anniversary of the enormous, strange, and still somewhat mystifying Tunguska event in Siberia. It took place in 1908. And that's the event many listeners will have seen images of it, where the thousands and thousands of trees were flattened by some sort of impact event, but it remains very mysterious because there's no actual crater there.
We know it was an antimatter explosion.
Yes, well, that's definitely one of the theories that is circulated, yes, especially among the UFO crowd. And so I was a speaker at the very first Asteroid Day, and this was my fourth time attending. It was held at the splendid Academy of Sciences in beautiful San Francisco this year on the 30th. And in addition to marking the anniversary of the B612 Foundation, we unveiled a very special award, which is the new Schweikart Prize. And it is, of course, named after the great Rusty Schweikart, whom listeners will know as the first human ever to fly the lunar module during the Apollo 9 mission, and has had a fascinating life. He's worked with Jacques Cousteau, worked as a politician, was a very early voice for environmental concerns, and had a long career with NASA, and very experienced pilot. Still a very active, charming, and brilliant gentleman. And so the prize was invented or conceived of in order to recognize people who have and will make outstanding contributions to the field of asteroid defense. And so the first one went to Rusty, and I'm very honored to have been one of the founding members of the Schweikart Prize. And it features, of course, a meteorite on top of a column, which I provided, of course, with the help of Aerolite Meteorites. And there was a really great moment there. We were in the press conference talking about the prize, and Rusty spoke, and several of his colleagues, Danica Remy, who is the head of Asteroid Day. And I looked around and I realized that I'm sitting in a room with 5 astronauts. So there was Rusty, of course, Ed Liu, who is the co-founder of B612 Foundation. I know he was a recent guest on the show. Jeffrey Hoffman, Anusha Ansari, and the mighty Franklin Diaz, who flew in space 7 times.
That's mighty. So
it was a fantastic day. There are wonderful organizations, and I would really encourage anyone who's interested in Earth defense and asteroids and technologies that we might use to deflect asteroids and also to find them before they encounter Earth, to visit B612 and become familiar with Asteroid Day. And they've done a wonderful thing with Asteroid Day. They've made it open source, a bit like Earth Day. So they don't exercise ownership over it. They started this wonderful thing and have invited others to do the same. So now there are numerous Asteroid Day events all over the world, and it's a growing movement and a very important one. And as someone whose career involves collecting fragments of asteroids that have crashed into the Earth, I can validate the importance of said program.
Well, that Jeff, was my next question. Because as you mentioned, you know, we recently were able to talk to Ed Liu about Asteroid Day and the risk to our planet that asteroids, you know, present, as well as the promise too, you know, for the future. But as someone that literally does go and pick up the pieces of these objects that are out there, you know, cavorting around the solar system on paths of their own, I'm curious what the asteroid threat or potential of these objects means to you. Because on one side, yes, there's this danger of big ones, you know, hitting our planet. The dinosaurs, you know, have firsthand knowledge of that. And on the other side, you know, they have these secret histories locked inside them, it seems like, of basically how everything around us formed around the sun.
Well, you're very astute, as always, Tarek, and there's an amusing irony in my very passionate support for Asteroid Day and B612. And actually, at the end of the day, we had a good-natured rust of Rusty, and he sat up on the stage, and a number of friends and colleagues went up and spoke, including myself. And one of the things I said to him was, Rusty, I really salute your work, and do please stop all of those big asteroids from hitting Earth. But if you could do me a favor and let a few of the just small ones please get through, because I do still need to have some work to do. And we had a good laugh about that. But seriously, meteorites, nearly all of which come from asteroids, as you know, but for the benefit of some of your listeners who may not be that familiar with the concept, we have a few meteorites from the moon, a few from Mars, but the vast majority of all meteorites that have ever landed on the Earth are believed to have come from asteroids. And so tiny fragments land all the time. It's only when there is a larger event, Chelyabinsk over Russia in 2013 being the most recent really major event, then for a while, everyone's talking about, oh, the danger of meteorite impacts, but then it tends to fade away from news media and public consciousness until the next one. So organizations like the B612 Foundation work ongoing to develop more effective methods of protecting the Earth. But I didn't really answer your question. What it means to me is, I'm going to hold something up to the camera here. So here's a fragment of an iron meteorite, and this is from the famous Sakhodolin fall in Russia in 1947, which formed about 101 craters. And this is a big, scary, twisted, sharp-looking piece of metal. It looks like it's almost identical to bomb case fragment. So having spent a lot of my time working in and around meteorite craters, I really get it. The devastation is immense. When you collect melted rock from the bottom of a meteorite crater that's millions of years old, you start to get a handle on the level of destruction that occurs when there is a large impact. And even to a smaller degree, the more minor meteorite events that have happened in our lifetimes or in recorded history, the Peekskill car, a few in New York in 1994, a few houses that have been hit, you see the fury of impact and the damage that is done by even a modest size meteorite. So when we expand that to something of the size that, say, formed Meteor Crater in northern Arizona, then we really need to start paying attention.
Yeah. So speaking of moderate size meteorites, we recently had an extraterrestrial visitor in New Jersey, which is like a fitting place for an extraterrestrial visitor to go, I think. Little meteorite fragment about 4 inches by 6 went through, I think the house looked like it was 2 stories, although they didn't say in the news accounts, went through either 1 or 2 roofs and ceilings, smashed into a wooden floor, ricocheted to a wall, and was found sitting there happily steaming away on the floor of this house. What do you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, in Hopewell, like an hour from my house. So.
Well, New York's had its famous Peekskill meteorite for many years, and New Jersey was envious, and so it wanted to have something hit as well. It's so similar to the famous 1950s Sylacauga, Alabama incident, okay. which where a meteorite went through a roof, ricocheted off a wall, but in that case, in that instance, hit an occupant. And it was a fascinating story. I'm always amazed by these something's been hit by a meteorite stories. This appears to be the real thing because often they're inaccurate, spurious one might
Didn't
say.
You hear about some kid that claimed he was whacked in the head with a meteorite?
Oh gosh, yeah. Well, we get a lot of these, Rod, over the years. There have been a lot of fake, I've been hit by a meteorite or I saw a meteorite story, one landed in my yard. And most of the fake ones involve some sort of variant of, well, it was burning hot and it sat glowing in my yard for 3 days, which, as we know, is not what happens to meteorites when they land. So immediately we know it's a bogus story. But every now and then there's a real one, although still to this day, the only positively documented case of a human being hit by a meteorite is the Sylacauga, Alabama story from the 50s. And that was a glancing blow. Mm-hmm. But yes, we've had a lot of weird ones. We've had people call us and insist they were hit by a meteorite and go, oh yeah, you know, it hit my arm and bounced off and here it is. And my reaction to that generally is if it had hit your arm, I don't think you'd be on the phone talking to us, but you'd probably be at the hospital if you could make it.
Well, I'm impressed by a couple of things with the Ann Hodges story in 1954, which is, first of all, that you couldn't pronounce Sylacauga, Alabama. But besides coming through the ceiling, I thought it was telling that it ricocheted off a radio. Because this is when people had big radios. It was big enough to ricochet off the radio, which I thought was kind of cool. It slammed into Ann Hodges' thigh, and it was a generous thigh, and gave her a very large bruise. And then she had to get involved in a lawsuit with her landlord to get possession of the meteorite, which she later donated to a museum, which is good of her.
Yes, I imagine. Well, if she were still around today, she would probably, perhaps I shouldn't speak for her, but perhaps she would be sorry that she had donated it, because that is one of the most desirable and sought after meteorites among collectors. Because any meteorite that's hit a human made object, and in this case, a person, is for whatever reason particularly enticing for collectors. And Rod, you mentioned another really interesting point, and I've always been fascinated by this. So in current American law, a meteorite belongs to the person upon whose land it fell. And if it's on federal land, then it technically belongs to the Smithsonian. So if that were to happen today, I doubt there would be a lawsuit, because the owner of the property should have claim to it. And there have been quite a few disputes over meteorite ownership. There was a famous one 25 years ago in Monahans, Texas, when a meteorite almost hit seven young men who were playing baseball outdoors. And my co-host, Steve Arnold, who was pre-Meteorite Men, but who would become my co-host in Meteorite Men, went down to the town and represented the families, represented their interests in a civil hearing, and won because the meteorite had fallen on property that belonged to one of the boys' parents, and the city had tried to claim ownership of it. So there's a lot of precedent for that.
But could you make the case? Could Anne, if it happened today, make the case that it hit my thigh before it hit the ground?
I knew you were going to say that.
And therefore it hit me first before it hit anywhere else. And so I'm like the landing point for it.
Maybe that's what she said. Tarek, you're absolutely brilliant. If the space.com thing doesn't work out for you, I think you should go to space law.
Okay, but wait a minute. She lived in a rented house that went through the ceiling of the rented house first, so it would be the landlord's meteorite.
Good point, Rod. But let's also remember that it doesn't technically become a meteorite until it hits the ground.
Yeah.
So does that's going true. Through the roof count as it being a meteorite? And I've said this a million times in public speaking and outreach. It's a meteor that we see in the sky, the shooting star. The object is a meteoroid.
Yeah.
And after impact, boom, when it hits the ground, meteorite. Mm. So there is a very interesting little bit of nitpicky space law here. We're gonna have to get someone to dig into this more deeply, I think.
Ooh,
maybe Mrs. Hodges' descendants will revisit.
I was gonna say, some episode when you're the guest co-host, we should have a meteorite litigation specialist come on.
We may have to create one for the episode, but I'm all for that.
Okay. Well, I have a couple of facts I want to rattle off, and then we're going to go to a sponsor break. But from Professor Stephen Nelson of Tulane University, odds of injury by meteorite. Drum roll, please. Lifetime odds of dying from a meteor strike near you, 1 in 1,600,000. Odds of being struck by lightning, 1 in 135,000. Odds of dying as the result of a meteor strike anywhere in the world, a catastrophic geologic event, 1 in 75,000. As opposed to the odds of winning the Powerball lottery, assumed presumably in the state where Tulane is, 1 to 195,249,54,000. So it seems like I have much better odds of dying of a extinction level event from a large asteroid hitting the Earth than winning the lottery.
Or getting hit by lightning. Oh my God.
So, is there money in there somewhere is my question.
And didn't your parents tell you not to waste money on the lottery? See, they were right. You would be better suited donating to B6 Club Foundation.
I was too old for there to be a lottery in the U.S.
Okay. I don't believe you for a second.
Oh, believe me. Modest. All right. Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we will be right back. So let's do a little classroom time, if we may. What are the types of meteorites and their origins in general?
We have three basic types of meteorites. And those are the irons, and I held one up earlier, stones and stony irons. And iron meteorites are the residue of the once molten core of large asteroids that have broken up and cooled and found their way to Earth. And stone meteorites are the most abundant. It's an awkward word to use because there is not an abundance of meteorites, but the most frequently recovered type of meteorite we would describe as a stone or stony, and they are primarily from the crust or mantle of asteroids, and a very few, as mentioned earlier, from the moon and Mars. And then the smallest and perhaps most intriguing of the three groups, the stony irons, divided into two classes, palisites and mesosiderites. And these are a really intriguing mixture of a nickel iron matrix and silicate inclusions. And in the case of palisites, which are the ones with the beautiful green crystals, the crystals are gemstones. They are olivine, which is the gemstone peridot. So they are not only beautiful, but very valuable and really sought after by collectors, and also fascinating to researchers because they are thought to have formed on a very narrow horizon in asteroids on the core mantle boundary. So we have a very tiny part of asteroids that produce palisites. And in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, all of those types, with very few exceptions, are rich in iron, which is why those listeners who may have seen Meteorite Men will always see us out in the boonies with metal detectors and magnets because we're searching for the iron nickel component that is common in most meteorites.
And it should be mentioned that Meteorite Man is now available to watch again.
Isn't that nice?
After a long absence, yes.
Yes. So it was a good few years ago that we filmed it. LMNO was our production company, and we originally made it for Science Channel, but then it became quite a popular show and aired on all seven continents, including Antarctica, which is not easy to air at McMurdo Station, but it was by special arrangement. And so, yes, we're back in the streaming world in glorious HD on Curiosity Stream and Spark and many other platforms. And that's made me very happy to see the show back out in the world again. Although I was a bit horrified when I realized how much silver my hair has acquired since
I was going to say, that's always the hard part about stuff coming back around is you look at yourself.
I know, right?
And you look like one of those Hollywood, big name actors that use their headshot from 25 years ago, but you look the same. So fear not.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you. I've had a few, of course, meteorite related scrapes and bruises since then. So I'm possibly a little bit more banged up, but hopefully still equally enthusiastic about my odd topic.
You know, I was curious, and forgive me if this is like a bonehead question, because you were telling us about the different types of meteorites. And of course that got me thinking about the different types of asteroids themselves. And the ones that I'm most familiar with are like S-type and C-type, even though I don't know what they mean half the time. And is there a relation between the different types of meteorites and those different types of asteroids? Like one is more rockier than metal or et cetera at all? Or is it just, are they just totally different classification systems?
Well, you're absolutely correct, Tarek, and it's a really actually fascinating question I've never been asked before. But yes, we do have different types of asteroids, and it's quite a complex topic, but a couple of the high points would be asteroids that we describe as being undifferentiated, meaning they didn't develop a molten core and they were not heavily altered by the action of water on the asteroid or other elements, produce meteorites that still have very distinct chondrules, those the little tiny spheres that go back to the beginning of the solar system. So those are very interesting for researchers. And differentiated asteroids that did develop a molten core, typically, we would imagine, larger asteroids have a different makeup, perhaps a little bit more similar to the Earth in that they're active. And we have seen slick inside in meteorites. And I mentioned the palisades that form at a certain horizon. So certain types of meteorites tell us that certain types of asteroids are active. Mm-hmm. But then also it gets more specific. And I'm a great fan of the OSIRIS-REx mission and the PI on that. Dante Loretta is a longtime friend and colleague. And we actually did a STEM Journals episode about OSIRIS-REx when it was under construction. So the asteroid Bennu that was picked for the OSIRIS-REx mission was based to some degree on what we know about meteorites. Uh-huh. They wanted to send this mission to an asteroid that may have been an origin source for carbonaceous chondrites, because that may give us unaltered carbon amino acids, possibly, and other super interesting things from asteroids. And also, just very briefly, Vesta is one of the few asteroids we know to be an origin point for meteorites. So the HED group, the Howardite, Eucrite, Diogenite group of meteorites, which have little, if any, iron, they're some of the anomalous meteorites. All of them, all the HED meteorites that we have on Earth are thought to come from Vesta. And when you look at the photographs and you see those enormous craters on Vesta, you can go, well, that's where my meteorite comes from.
That's pretty cool. I have a couple of burning questions I want to ask about weird meteorite stories.
Were they burning hot when they landed?
That's my next question too. So, but go ahead, Red.
But first, I don't want to forget to mention Avi Loeb, who we've talked about on the show before, famous, in some circles, infamous, head of the astronomy department at Harvard University, who was the person that sort of first posited the theory that perhaps Oumuamua, which is that large asteroid that came slinging through the solar system a few years back, was of extraterrestrial, they're all extraterrestrial, was of interstellar origins. And he started Project Galileo, which is partly to observe and seek unidentified anomalous phenomena. I always have to remind myself now, it's not just aerial, UAPs. But also part of that is that he raised some money to charter a ship to go off the coast of Papua New Guinea, where there was reportedly a breakup and impact in water of a meteorite that was thought to be of interstellar origins. And he apparently came up with some stuff. And I assume you saw that story and the little ball bearings that he managed to pick up that are kind of weird looking. But isn't that what metal would do if it was melted in a weightless vacuum?
I'm so fascinated by all of this. I don't know how. I guess we're always a bit cautious when we start talking about things like this, and it immediately makes me think of the meteorite ALH84001 that was found in Antarctica in 1984, and there were sensational news stories at the time because it seemed that there was a little fossil worm or a bacteria that was found in it. And you know, definitive decisions still not being made. There are those for and those against, and that's a different story. But those of us that are passionate about the science world, we're always a little bit cautious when it comes to, well, this could be evidence of alien something, because it's easy to get lumped together with people who maybe have more extreme theories. But first of all, I really take my hat off to him for finding anything underwater.
Yes.
And I'd say the most frequent question I'm asked when I'm speaking in public is, have you ever found a meteorite underwater? I don't know why this is such a popular topic, but statistically, when you think about it, most meteorites land in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought there was a possibility of recovering meteorites under certain circumstances. But as mentioned earlier, meteorites are rich in iron and oceans are rich in salt water. So not an ideal environment in many cases. I really look forward to reading more about this story. I'm both skeptical and intrigued. What do you gents think?
Well, I mean, if something could, I don't know how you do it, but if something, let's say there was a serial number stamped on one of those ball bearings in Klingon, that suddenly gets very, very, very interesting. And of course, then, you know, you've got to run it past all the doubters in the science community. But I think it's a fascinating story. I think more than anything, though, I take my hat off to this guy who is in a very important major position in science in the United States, who's been willing to skate way out into the thin ice. I mean, the thinnest of ice, talking about what he does. And he's, you know, he's very clear about it. He says, look, let's just keep an open mind. And he's gotten a lot of pushback for it. And I also hats off to Harvard University for not trying to rein him in when he talks about these things,
because
a lot of universities would.
Well, and Rod, it was in the 1800s, any scientist who said meteorites were rocks that fell from space would have been branded a lunatic. And it really wasn't until the Legla meteorite fall in the 19th century in France, when so many meteorites fell during the daytime over an agricultural area where people were working, that it was impossible to deny any longer. It was in large part a religious dictum, that the view of the church was, well, God created heaven and heaven is perfect, so we can't possibly have debris falling out of heaven. That would imply an imperfection in the great creator. But there comes an event that's so definitive. And by the way, I have had the opportunity to see some of those original stones that were collected in the 1800s at the Natural History Museum in London, with their perfect black fusion crust and their beautiful handwritten labels by Biot, the famous French scientist who went to the site. So it's not that long ago that something we now take to be a given was also regarded as completely far-fetched. I will make a caveat, and I will give Professor Loeb the benefit of the doubt here, because I've been misquoted a million times. But in the articles that I've read, I think every one of them has said they're investigating a meteor that landed in the waters off Papua New Guinea in 2014. And I would hope that Harvard knows the difference between a meteor and a meteorite, but that's probably the press. I always get a bit worried, though, when someone says, we found a meteor, because no, you didn't. We're up in the sky.
You know, I wanted to ask, I mean, you raise a really good point. If I remember correctly, ALH, that meteorite was a Mars meteorite, was it not? The one that NASA trumped up and was like, hey, look what we found. And they had a big press conference.
They didn't trump it up. It's a rock they found.
Well, to
the White House public relations staff that pushed the agenda forward.
Oh, my God. Oh. All right. Hold on. Excuse me.
Did you just fall off your chair again?
I did. Hold on.
Oh, my God. Jeff, don't wait for him. This could take all day.
He's falling off his chair with excitement. So, yes, Tariq, you are absolutely correct. And we should say that ALH stands for Allen Hills. Mm-hmm. So it was a meteorite that was found during one of the Antarctic Search for Meteorite expeditions, an early one in 1984. And ALH 84001 means it was the first meteorite found on the 1984 expedition. And you're absolutely correct. It is a Martian meteorite. And, I mean, imagine how thrilled they must have been. Well, first of all, we found a meteorite. It's a Martian meteorite, and it's that a fossilized worm in it. So I think the furor of interest in this possible sign of life was increased by the fact that it came from Mars, because you could go, well, if we were going to get a meteorite that had a fossil in it, would probably come from Mars, right? I guess the odds are maybe better.
Well, I don't know if I told you this, Jeffrey, but when I was up at Pascal Lee's Arctic base last summer, our camp manager was a gentleman.
You big show off.
I know.
You know, you've never been, Jeff? You've never been?
I have to take those opportunities when I can, because my life is so humble. But our camp manager was named John Scott, and he's run the Antarctic Meteorite Collection Program for, I think, 33 seasons.
Well, why haven't you got an invite for us yet?
I know. And what I had to ask him, of course, because I'm me, was so those all belong to the National NSF, right?
NSF.
He goes, yeah. And I said, you telling me you never saw anybody? I didn't ask if he did. You never saw anybody pocket even a little chip? And he stared at me stonily and said, never. And I said, okay.
Rod, you just said the unmentionable thing.
I know. I'm such a barbarian. I couldn't help it. But what a cool thing to do. And from the sounds of it, you know, when you're ski-doing along down there, if you see something dark in the distance, it's either, you know, dog feces or a meteorite, because there's really very little else out on the icy plains.
Wait, they have ice dogs out there?
Well, they have sled dogs, don't they?
I'm just kidding. My friend,
Scott's corpse, but
you know, my friend Christopher Kokinos, who is a wonderful science author, joined the program and wrote a brilliant book about meteorites called The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars, which I cannot recommend highly enough for anyone who's interested. It's one of my two all-time favorite books about meteorites. And I have to say, Rod, since you now know the guy in charge, I have absolutely come to terms with the fact that if we go to Antarctica and we find meteorites, we cannot keep any of them. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with it. I just want a photograph of picking one up out of the ice with gloves or tongs or whatever. I think it would be a fantastic.
Well, that's if we go with them. If you and I just go on our own, which I wouldn't advise dragging me along, but you know, I do have natural warming features, but if you and I just go, we can collect anything we want.
I will tell you that we did quite enthusiastically investigate doing a Meteorite Men episode there, which that would have been fun. Very expensive. And I said, it's okay, let's do it as a two-parter. Then it'll only be half the cost. And I won't name any names because some parties were very helpful and supportive, and other parties made it very clear that we were not at all welcome. And should we get in trouble? The quote was, when you get in trouble, don't call us for help. Mm. Wow. Which was enough for production to go, forget about this. Let's go on to the next location.
Yeah, hard to get an insurance bond on that trip.
No kidding. One day.
Well, I'm better now, by the way.
Yeah, don't move around. It's dangerous for you to move around. Stop shifting. All right. What's your question, sir?
Well, so I was like halfway through it. And I guess the question that I wanted to ask about is how careful when you find a meteorite, do you need to be, or does the public need to be, someone who finds one on it, you know, to make sure that they don't either leap to conclusions, A, that it's a meteorite, or B, that it has, you know, microbes from Mars or whatever, or that they don't, you don't mess it up, you know, any more than it is, because it's had a pretty harrowing journey to land in your driveway, like in England, or in someone's house, like, you know, in Hopewell, New Jersey, or something like that. I mean, it seems like very sturdy, but at the same time, you don't want to make it worse than it already is.
Can I say, please, how wonderful it is to be asked questions that I've never been asked before? It really does not happen very often.
It happens to Tarek all the time.
Twice today, Tarek. Brilliant. Well, we could do a whole show just on this. Here are the bullet points on this. If we were at a site looking for ancient meteorites that have been on the ground for hundreds or thousands of years, we wouldn't be overly concerned. Figuring, well, they've already survived a burning passage through the atmosphere and crashed into the earth at several hundred miles an hour, and then probably been buried in the desert for a few thousand years. I'm being facetious, but how much damage could we really do? So we do, of course, exercise care, and sometimes we want to know how deeply buried the meteorite was. We worked with NASA one time in Kansas at a site, and they wanted to remove a meteorite with the soil still attached so they could do very accurate dating on the find, which was fascinating. So yes, a reasonable amount of care, perhaps similar to if we were doing a paleontological excavation. If it's a recently fallen meteorite, very recently fallen, say we are following a fireball, as was the case with the Waco fireball in 2009, which became the Ash Creek meteorite. It's very important to recover it quickly and carefully. And the sooner the better, because this material that became a meteorite has been in splendid isolation in space for millions or perhaps billions of years, pretty close to absolute zero. And then suddenly it lands on this, what's this planet with all this rain and moisture and animals walking around and farm equipment? Holy cow, what's this fertilizer that I fell in? So we've got delicate fusion crusts. Carbonaceous chondrites, as mentioned, may have amino acids. And so the more quickly they are collected and delivered to our colleagues in academia for study, the better. And so, yes, there's a time element and also care. And at that instance, the Ash Creek fireball and the Buzzard Cooley fireball, which fell in Canada in the late fall of 2008, both of which I got to relatively soon after the fall, particularly Ash Creek and Park Forest, which we should mention. All examples of all of three of these, by the way, are in my upcoming meteorite auction, which I know we're going to talk about in a minute, but that just occurred to me. In each of these instances, we were able to recover meteorites either very quickly after they fell, within a few days, or in the case of Buzzard Cooley, it fell and was immediately covered by snow and was frozen for several months. And we got there just when it was thawing. So the meteorites we covered were reasonably close to pristine. And this is very appealing to researchers to get something like this. So we're super excited to get to the fall site. Are we going to find anything? How quickly can we find a meteorite after it's landed? And then there really has been a race. Let's put it, seal it in an airtight bag and put it really in a FedEx envelope and send it to Center for Meteorite Studies at ASU, or whichever one of our colleagues were working with at the time, or different scientists, of course, have different areas of specialization, and whichever lab may be best suited to receive that. And there have been a couple of instances in my life where we've done that. And wow, is that exciting.
And so, you said earlier that if you get there, like if it falls on your house or if you get there right after it fell, it's not going to be hot. How come it's not hot? Right? It just burned up through the atmosphere.
Yes. Here's another one of the fascinating seeming anomalies or contradictions of meteorites. So we see a fireball in the sky, and nickel iron has to be heated to up between 2,000 and 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit to melt. So it's really hot. But then as the incoming mass that we call a meteoroid gets closer to the surface of the Earth, it compresses the air ahead of it and it slows down. And there comes a point where it just falls. And that point is typically pretty high up, 7, 10, 12, 15 miles, where the air is cold. So in most cases, as far as we know, incoming meteorites, have the chance to cool down before they hit the surface. The largest potential meteorites that would make something like Meteor Crater, they don't care about the atmosphere. They don't even see that. They just punch through that. But yes, modest-sized meteorites that don't make a crater, according to the majority of reports we have, which are not that many, when someone's seen a meteorite fall and they immediately go up and touch it, which I probably wouldn't do for multiple reasons, it's either cold or slightly warm to the touch, are the reports that we've had.
Wow.
Yeah, and haven't there actually been reports of some that generated frost after they arrived?
Yeah. Yes, a couple.
Which is kind of counterintuitive, especially if you watch the War of the Worlds as a child. So,
which I did multiple times.
Oh, yeah. A funky meteorite, but cool movie. So I can't let you go without hearing about your weirdest meteorite find story and your scariest meteorite hunting story, because I know you've got lots of both.
I do. Oh, this is fun. I'd say my weirdest story was in Park Forest, a suburb of Chicago in 2003. I had been all over the world before and after. I don't know what it is about meteorites. I don't know why they seem to fall in the Sahara or Siberia or the Australian outback. I'm being silly because they fall everywhere, but it seems that the best meteorite hunting locations are often in the most inaccessible places. Mm. But in this case, March of 2003, there was a major fireball over Chicago and hundreds of meteorites fell, a couple of baseball-ish sized ones and lots of smaller ones. And my hunting colleagues and I, Steve Arnold, again, from Meteorite Men, and John Sinclair, a very good friend, expert meteorite hunters both, we decided to go to the small end. So when multiple meteorites fall, we tend to, this also seems contrary, but it's laws of physics. The smaller ones fall first, little ones fall first. The larger masses have a bit more inertia and they go a bit further. So we tend to find smaller ones grouped together and then fewer bigger ones and then maybe a couple of big ones at the end. And we were at the small end of the strewn field and I found two in parking lots. In the suburbs of Chicago, one in the parking lot of an attorney's office, which I'm pleased to say was the genesis of space law, and another one in the forecourt of a bank. And that's the only time in my life that's happened. The scariest would definitely be when I was hunting again with Steve, who's been my hunting partner for many years, in Kansas. At a site where we had found large meteorites before, the Brenham, Kansas site where we filmed part of the pilot of Meteorite Men, where we'd found some enormous Palisite meteorites. And we were dragging a very large metal detector coil over the ground and we got a whopping target. It really howled through the speakers. We go, oh, this is one. So we stop, unhook the detector, pinpoint it, start digging, dig. And it's a farm. It's Kansas farmland. There's a bit of soil and then you get into the clay and it's hard. It's viscous. So we're digging. And you know how you get in the bottom of a hole and you dig and then you get out and you get in and do this. So we're doing this. And fortunately, we're both out of the hole when the entire bottom of the hole collapsed into a void. Wow. And there was this sigh like, and I thought, oh, we've accidentally uncovered the entrance to the underworld.
The mummy's curse, right?
And I just ran. I ran so fast. And Steve is standing there laughing with his shovel. And he goes, man, I did later. I did not know you could move that fast. I went over a little hill and I cowered there expecting something like the Mole Man and his minions to come out of this thing with laser guns and everything. And we'd uncovered an uncapped oil well.
Wow.
And it was the metal of the side of the pipes that went down to the well that we had found. And ever since that day, I never stand in the bottom of a hole when I'm digging.
Well, let me just point out, because you and I talked about this a little yesterday. You know, when I thought of drill bore, I thought maybe a hole 5 inches diameter, but apparently that's wrong. It's much bigger, right?
It was. Yes. Oh, sorry. I was spacing out for a minute there. I was just thinking, I was remembering peering down into that void and wondering what must have waited me down there. It was much bigger than I expected, too, Rod. Yes. So you think of drilling and you think of a little thing like, I don't know, what is it? The size of a milkshake thing.
Yeah.
No, this was massive. This was like a big, like a, the size of a culvert that you'd see under a highway. So you could easily have fallen into it. I don't know, 4 feet across maybe in diameter.
Wow. That is horrifying.
Yeah, it was horrifying.
Okay, so did you do the thing where you dropped a rock or a chem light to see how far it was?
Of course we did.
Did you ever hear it hit?
Yeah, it took a while. And there was liquid down there. I don't know if it was oil or water or nitric acid or...
Wow.
I don't know.
The blood of the mole people.
Could have been anything.
That could have been short work for you. Yeah. That is rather terrifying.
Yes, definitely. Well, one of the scariest moments. Of course, there was the horde of hornets and there was the breaking down and getting lost in the Atacama Desert and being stopped by the Mexican army in the middle of nowhere. But those are just side stories, perhaps for another time.
Mexican army, really?
Yeah. With machine guns.
Well, they all have machine
guns. Fortunately, we were not shot. They thought we were drug runners. And when we show them our metal detectors, they go, oh, it's just treasure hunters. Who cares? They were very nice about it. But no, really, I mean, we were cowering in a ditch when this big Mexican army truck goes by and it stopped right by us because they saw our truck out in there. We did have permission to be where we were. But we were also told that the neighboring property was of a drug lord. And so they jumped out with their machine guns. It really was like an action film. And we thought we better turn ourselves in. So we just stood up and waved and they motioned us over. We showed them the metal detectors and they go, that's nothing.
Well, having had one very, very brief encounter with the Mexican army down in Puerto Escondido, most of the soldiers looked like they were about 13 years old, nervously fingering their M16s, which made me extremely nervous.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, most of the guys were pretty young and they probably wouldn't have been too worried about losing a couple of American, they imagined, tourists.
All right. Well, we're going to come back with Tariq's next and possibly final burning question as soon as we take a short break for our sponsor.
Well, Jeff, you know, we've been talking about meteorites this whole episode, and you kind of teased the question that I've got next is that you've got an auction coming up of some of your finds. And I'm curious, you know, what you do have that we should be looking for and what it means for Aerolite and all of the stuff that you've got ahead. What should people be looking for?
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate your interest, Tariq. It's been a fascinating experience for me. I'm working with Heritage Auctions in Dallas, and the auction's actually live now. There will be an in-person event on July 22nd, but it's open for bidding and all the lots up there. We have 142 lots, and these are primarily pieces from my collection, my personal collection. Some pieces that I found, I wanted it to be fun. So there's some amusing stuff from Meteorite Men, my wardrobe from the first episode, and some of my metal detectors and fun stuff. There is a beautiful sculpture of the Meteorite Men made in Lego by Dave Shaddix, who is quite a famous Lego artist. But wow. Mostly it's some of the most beautiful or intriguing meteorites from my collection. And I've been doing this for 30 years. And I was always very clear, well, this is a Jeff collection piece and this is an Aerolite Meteorites piece. So Aerolite Meteorites is alive and well, still thriving company, and we're at aerolite.org if anyone's interested in learning more. But the auction is something I wanted to do. I wanted to put these pieces back out into the world after enjoying them for decades. And I've selected six charities and nonprofits that will be beneficiaries of a significant part of the proceeds, including some kids charities and wildlife and the Association of Applied Paleontological Sciences, which is a wonderful organization I've been a member of for 25 years that works to build good relationships between academia and collectors. So it's live now at Heritage Auctions. It's HA as in heritageauctions.com/Notkin, or you can just go to meteorites.link, and oh my gosh, as a photographer and an art guy and a science guy and a science writer, I'm being objective here. This is one of the loveliest catalogs that I've seen, and all the credit goes to Heritage. I didn't do the photographs, to their photography department, their design department. They really make meteorites look like magical sculptures from outer space, which they are, but you don't always see them that way when they're presented in a more scientific way. But they have beautiful blue backgrounds, and I wrote some essays for the catalog. It's 132 pages. I wanted it to be a book. I wanted it to be an artifact that people who are interested in meteorites could have, not just a listing of lots, but profiles of some of the great collectors in history. I wrote an essay about why museum numbers and specimen identification cards are so important and so interesting to me. And there's I suppose my favorite bit is a feature called the Sakodaline Zoo. Now I mentioned this, this is a Sakodaline meteorite. I mentioned this earlier in the show, this enormous fall in 1947 in Eastern Russia. And that's a shrapnel fragment that exploded when a crater was formed, but many pieces landed on their own as individuals, and they acquired these incredible shapes, natural sculptures melting during flight. And so I've collected them for decades, and I go, oh, well, that one looks like an owl, and that one looks like a shark. And this one is obviously a bunny rabbit. And so they were put together in an assemblage called the Sakodaline Zoo. There's a dragon. Actually, there are two dragons. There's a Welsh dragon and there's a sleeping dragon. So my colleagues go, you know, Jeff, not every meteorite looks like an animal. And I go, no, you're wrong. It's just a question of finding the right lighting. And I'm an art guy and I love zoomorphic things. So for me, that's one of the highlights. And it's their individual lots. We just presented them as this collective, the Sakodaline Zoo. And I also just mentioned there's a marvelous article that just came out yesterday on intelligentcollector.com, which is a marvelous online publication. And they did an interview with me, but mostly asked me to write about some of my favorite pieces and why. And so anyone who's interested, if you go to intelligentcollector.com, it's right on the front page. And I wrote a piece about how I fell in love with a real vintage old tech metal detector that shouldn't work for finding meteorites, but was one of the best things ever and is actually one of the lots in the auction. I don't know how I decided to part with that, but there you go.
And for folks that are looking to add to their collection there, I mean, what's the start? Yeah. What's the close of the auction? So you have the live event on the 22nd. Is that yes. the final day then?
Or, yes, sir.
They don't have a lot of time. So.
No. So couple of weeks, bidding's open, and there will be on the 22nd. It's every option there. I will be there. I'll be at Heritage headquarters in Dallas. It'll be a fun event. So there's floor bidding, there's phone bidding, proxy bidding. You can place a bid in advance. You can live bid on the day, and they're a really fantastic company to work with. And as you gentlemen know, I did an auction last year, similar, it was such a wonderful event. We decided to do it again and to pick different charities, more charities. But, I was very excited to see all of the tech that's involved, and there, you'll appreciate this as tech guys. They really make it easy to participate. So again, it's ha.com/knock if anyone wants to see that. And we did a bunch of videos as well. We filmed numerous exclusive videos, some of which are just life history of meteorites. So the Heritage team said, Jeff, pick your five favorite meteorites that have the wackiest story and tell us why. So if you would like to learn more about the subject, that is not a bad venue.
Well, this has been fun as always, and I'm going to see you again in a couple of weeks, and I'm looking forward to that. But I want to thank everybody for joining us for our friendly chat with our old pal, Jeffrey Nocken, the OG meteorite man himself. Where can we keep up with your activities beyond the auction, Jeff?
Well, I am very active on social media. I am at Jeff Nocken, GEOFFNOTKIN, on just about everything. And as Rod noted earlier, I am the founder and partner in Aerolite Meteorites. We are aerolite.org. And if you want to learn more about a wacky show in which two crazy rockheads travel all over the world looking for rocks that have allegedly fallen from heaven, check out meteoritemen.com or curiosity.stream or any other of multiple platforms where Meteorite Men lives again.
And we're very happy about that. Tarek, same question for you, sir.
Yes, well, I'm at space.com, SPACE.com, as always. And then, of course, if I'm feeling Twitter-tastic, I'm at Tarek J. Malik on Twitter. And that's about it for me, though. That's where you'll find me, except it's the weekend and I don't have any launches to worry about for the most part. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I'm still choking on Twitter-tastic, but all right. You can always find me at pilebooks.com and at astromagazine.com. Please don't forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. We always welcome your comments, suggestions, and ideas, especially the nice ones. And jokes. Don't forget the jokes.
Meteorite jokes this time, please.
Please. And don't forget to check out space.com, the websites in the name, and the National Space Society at nss.org. Both are good places to satisfy your spaceflight cravings after you listen to this podcast, not before. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so be sure to subscribe, tell your friends, and give us reviews. We love all reviews, 5 stars, thumbs up, big smooch, whatever you got. Or you could head to our website at twit.tv/twis. Don't forget, you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit, as well as some extras, but they're a secret until you get there, for only $7 a month. And you can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and twit.tv on Instagram. Thank you all, and we'll see you next week.
Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here. In case you hadn't heard, Home Theater Geeks is back. Each week, I bring you the latest audio-video news, tips and tricks to get the most out of your AV system, product reviews, and more. You can enjoy Home Theater Geeks only if you're a member of Club Twit, which costs $7 a month, or you can subscribe to Home Theater Geeks by itself for only $2.99 a month. I hope you'll join me for a weekly dose of Home Theater Geekitude.